And welcome to the second season opener of the Sensitive Skin Podcast. I'm your host, Bernard Meisler. I'm the editor-in-chief of Sensitive Skin Magazine. And yeah, this is the real deal. This is episode one, none of this episode zero nonsense. And our guest today is the fantastic and terrific and acclaimed Russian-American poet Anton Yakovlev. And this coincides with the release this week of his fantastic book, The Last Poet of the Village, which is selected poems by Sergei Yesenin, which Anton translated. Many of you may not have heard of Yesenin, although he is probably the second most popular Russian poet of all time among Russian speakers. As Anton says, there's very few people in Russia who couldn't recite several of his poems by heart. Many of his poems have been used in pop lyrics in modern Russia. Sadly, he's not that well known outside of Russia. And he's probably best known because he had a torrid love affair with Isadora Duncan. At any rate, this book is coming out this week. It's currently available on Amazon in print version. And if you don't want to buy it from Amazon, feel free to go to your local bookseller and ask for it. Or go to your local library and ask for it. They'll get you a copy. This is a bilingual edition with Russian, the original Russian, side by side with the translation by Anton. And we had a good talk. We spoke about his upbringing in Russia, his poetry background, and how he attempted to do this book. He didn't try to do a word-for-word translation. It's similar to Jenny Wade's Mayakovsky Maximum Access. We're not trying to, like, keep rhyme and meter so much as opposed to actually get to the heart of the matter. Well, this is a big week for Sensitive Skin because lot going on besides the launch of the podcast today. Also coming out this week is the first Sensitive Skin anthology, Selected Writing 2016 to 2018. That's also available on pre-order right now from Amazon, shipping Thursday, or the Kindle version's already available right now. And it's a collection of short stories, poems, and essays that we published online from 2016 to 2018. And we stopped doing the print version at the end of 2015 for a lot of reasons. First of all, it gets really expensive. Second of all, I wasn't happy with a lot of reproduction of the art quality sometimes. And thirdly, this is just the world we live in. It seems like it's better to release stuff as I get it rather than waiting to do it once a year in a print version and then putting the stuff on the site. So since then, we've started, you know, printing stuff, publishing pieces on the site once or twice a week, and it seems to work. We're getting twice as much traffic as we used to. Maybe we would have gotten that anyway. How could I know? We'll never know. At any rate, this is a fantastic book. It looks beautiful. It's got a beautiful cover photograph by Philip Pocock, and there's stories by, oh my goodness, so many people. I don't want to read them all to you because I'll leave some of them out, and it's just too long. But I mean, geez, we've got some heavyweights in here. We've got Hal Sierowitz. We've got Bob Holman. We've got Jack Hirschman, Thurston Moore, Shavisa Woods, Sharon Mesmer, Timothy Leary, some letters Timothy Leary wrote to Allen Ginsberg, Carl Watson, Ron Combe, J.D. King, Julia Cassina. Oh my goodness, the list goes on and on. Steve Dalachinsky, Yuko Otomo, Todd Colby, Thaddeus Rutkowski, Max Blagg, Jeff Wright, Anton Yakovlev, again, who I'm interviewing today. Yeah, it's great. So pick it up. Check it out. Sensitive Skin, Selected Writing. You can find it on Amazon. And again, ask your local bookseller or library to get you a copy. And again, it's also on Kindle. And I know times are tough out there. I know you're mad as hell and you can't take it anymore. So the Kindle version's only $4.99. How about that? One more thing coming out this week is my novel, There's Never Been a Better Time to Die, and which is a neo-noir satire about life in Marin County, California, during our lovely time of late-stage capitalism. Here, I'll read you one blurb I just got. The best satire about Mill Valley since the serial. Many have tried and many have failed, but Meisler hits Marin County's quirky nail smack in the head with his hard-boiled real estate agent's noir cynicism. Filled with homages and insider snarks, I laughed on damn near every page. Meisler will either get Mill Valley's acclaim or he'll get run out of town. I like that one because it's probably true. I took my author photograph off the rear cover just so they don't put it on a wanted poster or anything like that. That's from J. Mason King, the publisher of the MillValleyLit.com site. And I got a lot more blurbs. I got so many people saying nice things about me. Anyway, that book's out later this week as well. You can always go to our site, SensitiveSkinMagazine.com, and click on the books link, and you'll see all this stuff. Wow. So is that nuts or what? Not one, not two, three books coming out. Anton Yakovlev's The Last Poet of the Village, Selected Poems of Sergei Yesenin, Sensitive Skin, Selected Writing 2016 to 2018, and finally my novel by Bernard Meisler. There's Never Been a Better Time to Die. It's funny. I think you'll like it. People like it. Amazed. And wait, am I done? No. We will also be appearing at San Francisco Lit Crawl this Saturday, October 19th at 5 p.m. at the Valencia Room, 647 Valencia Street in San Francisco. 5 o'clock sharp. That should be fun. And I'll have all of these books there for sale at a steep discount. Huh. It's been a busy couple of weeks trying to get all this shit together. Am I out of my damn mind or what? Well, we all know the answer to that. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Anton Yakovlev. How's it going?
Good. I am doing okay. How are you?
Oh, you know, I'm just switching back and forth from angst to ennui to anger, you know.
Yeah,
it's been an interesting week.
I was getting over the jet lag for my from Barcelona, and as soon as the jet lag was officially over, like within a day, I got a cold, possibly, that I caught on the plane.
Yeah.
So if my voice is a little raspier than usual, that's why, but okay. I'm okay otherwise, you know, nothing.
What were you doing in Barcelona?
It was just vacation. I mean, basically, my parents, my father had a conference in Valencia, and then they decided to just go to Tossa de Mar, which is sort of north on Costa Brava. And then they rented a house that was like extremely cheap at an Airbnb because it was basically out of season, like the first week after the season was over.
Right.
But it was a three-bedroom house downtown that was built in 1700. So it was a really fascinating place to spend a few days.
That sounds great. And
my father and I walked alongside the, we did a hike for about 5 hours along the ocean and going into some mountains, some hills, into several villages. Basically, you know, it was just a really nice sightseeing experience and kind of an intense hike. Swam a couple of times a day, went to Dalí's house in Cadaqués. And in Barcelona, there was... I went to Barcelona after my parents went home, and I stuck around for like three more days. And there's the festival called La Merced, which is one of the biggest holidays in Barcelona. Goes on for like 5 days, and they have like concerts. They have devil exercising with lots of fireworks
That
and
sounds great.
all sorts of great, interesting things.
Yeah, what was
So,
Dali's house like?
Dali's house is absolutely another world. Like, it's basically, oh, I should have worn the shirt that I bought there with a Dali elephant. You can understand why he had painted so many great paintings. It's very easy, I feel. It would be very easy to, like, if you are a genius painter, it would be like the ideal place to cultivate your talent with constant nonstop inspiration just by looking at your surroundings. It's like basically this house in like in front of like a little fishing bay and lots of boats, lots of just like small beach, very picturesque. And they actually had an apartment for sale that was like across the street from the house, which I was like, oh, I wish I could afford that. And they had
How
the
much
boat.
does it cost? I want to know.
I have not even researched that, but maybe I will, and
Yeah.
I will report
Yeah.
back to you. I didn't really
Okay.
quite go that far. I was just like, oh wow, isn't that great? But there is a boat that is named after his wife, Adela, I guess, and you can still take the boat. Unfortunately, it was too late in the day, so I couldn't do it. But if I ever go back, but like yeah, just like it's the exact boat that they used to go out on the
Oh, cool.
bay, and they do hourly tours and that.
Yeah, what does your dad do that he was there for a conference
He's
for?
a math professor, so he teaches at the Worcester Polytechnic Institute. And that's why we came to the United States. He got a job there in 1996, and he has been there ever since.
Okay.
So he goes on a number of conferences, usually like a couple of conferences a year, and a lot of them happen to be in Europe. So he frequently combines them with some sort of vacation afterwards, if he can, once a year, basically. Last year, I joined them in Sicily in the same in a similar way,
So
but.
was it a lot easier to leave the was it still the Soviet Union in 1996, or was it
It wasn't, no, it
it
was
was the
Russian Federation. Yeah, the Soviet Union fell in 1991.
it was 91. Okay. I
Yeah,
was
no, I
never quite sure. It
mean,
seemed like a kind of a long drawn out process from Gorbachev to Yeltsin and the attempted coups and all that stuff. So I wasn't quite
yeah.
sure when the official changeover took, but.
Well, yeah, it's interesting that you call it drawn out because to me, it was actually like growing up there, it felt fairly sudden. Like the actual fall of the Soviet Union was pretty quick. I mean, the Berlin Wall fell in 1989 in Germany, and then in 1991 was the attempted coup after there had already been a fair amount of reform and the perestroika that had been going on since
And that was
85.
Gorbachev still.
That was Gorbachev, yeah. And then that was August 1991, and then after that, by like end of December, I think December 25th or something, is when the Soviet Union officially stopped existing. But even like in 87, 88, the idea that Soviet Union would completely collapse, like would completely be just annulled, was something that the most radical people were saying. Like it was a very radical position. Like Andrei Sakharov, the great scientist who was in the parliament at that time, like he was of the opinion that you should just let it go, and then maybe like a new some sort of a different kind of union could be recreated later, but that first all the republics should go their separate ways and not be forced to stay together. But that was kind of like that was kind of a cutting edge, opinion to have. But then after the fall of the Berlin Wall, within like 2 years, it
It
was
was all
very.
over. It was all over after the Berlin Wall came down. And I remember I was
Yeah.
actually living in Paris at that time and following that whole story very closely. And it was amazing how quickly it happened. You
Yeah.
know,
Yeah.
that it was just like no. And there, you know, and then all of a sudden the guards abandoned the wall, and that was it. And people just went through and. And they just rip the thing down in like 3 days. Like everybody from both sides just like went, yeah, let's take this thing down.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that was when I visited Berlin in 2004, I saw a checkpoint where the guard that was guarding it on the day of the official end of, you know, the separation, he didn't get the memo. So like 6,000 people show up and demand to cross. He thought that he was supposed to start shooting at them. And then he was like, well, you know, I'm not going to take that on my conscience. Let's just let them go.
Right.
So he just made that decision to basically disobey his commands. And then later, like an hour later, he found out, oh, that's what he was supposed to do. They actually were okay to go through.
Yeah. And then Romania, the Ceausescus were overthrown like just a couple months later. Yeah. And
Oh, yeah. I remember that very well, actually, watching that on TV.
Yeah.
And all of that. Yeah. It really seemed like the end of an era. I mean, for a while, like growing up, the only constant for me was constant change. Mm-hmm. Like I was really used to things being, and of course I was growing up expecting like really sort of full democracy to come pretty soon, you know, or less than 10 years later. But it kind of became it didn't quite get there, and you know, that's
we're waiting for it here. We're waiting for it in America too. So,
yeah. I mean, I have to. Yeah, I think the paradoxical thing is that it is still like, except for some of the time in the 90s when it was so kind of lawless and chaotic. Like there was a lot of freedom, but it was really hard to live there. That's why we came to the United States, because my parents, you know, my father couldn't really. He was working in the Russian Academy of Sciences, and he just didn't. He couldn't make a living.
Yeah,
essentially.
And people were starving, right?
I mean, I didn't like literally starve. I mean, my parents kind of sheltered me from that, but it was very, you know, very much on the edge of that.
Right.
And a lot of anxiety. So you know, it was. On the other hand, it was kind of a period of freedom, or just kind of like, but it was like also a period of lawlessness. Mm-hmm. And then since then, it became, of course, a lot, you know, a bit more authoritarian and more constricted. Although, you know, the thing to remember, and the thing that I kind of, as much as I am concerned about the current regime and very worried about how it's going to develop, and that was a really part of the reason that I haven't even been going back to Russia since then. So, like, I'm not positive about that at all. But at the same time, I have to remind myself that compared to all of kind of recorded Russian history, this is more freedom than people have ever had.
Interesting.
You know, any time in the Soviet Union and any time in the feudal times before that.
Yeah, so. And the feudal times didn't end that long ago. I mean, when were the serfs free? It was like 1848 or something like that? Or
1861, I think. So basically it was around the same time as the slavery, you know, the Civil War in the United States. It was like the official slavery ended around the same time.
Yeah. There's a lot of parallels between Russia and America like that, I think. And where were you in Russia? Where did you, what part of Russia did you grow up in?
In Moscow,
okay.
Yeah, pretty central, like near the university area.
Yeah, okay.
And the Olympic Stadium. Or, you know, it wasn't quite downtown. I mean, probably like maybe a 40-minute, maybe half-hour subway ride into like the center city to Kremlin. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, but in 1959, when my grandfather moved into that apartment, it was kind of the outskirts of the city.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I was born, it was like there was a lot of more.
But it was still like that. So your grandfather had an apartment. So your parents then lived there. That was the place to live, and then you lived there.
My grandfather was a coach of track and field for Soviet Olympic team. So he was like, obstacle course. Was that Hurdle runs when he was young, and then he became a coach, and he was like traveling around for quite a lot of places. And so yeah, somehow he was placed like kind of like near the what became the Olympic Village.
Okay.
And yeah, I mean, it was like a very small apartment, and grew up with like five people in a two-bedroom apartment, basically. So it was a nice area, but definitely very cramped.
But it was at least just your family. There weren't multiple families in the apartment, which was pretty
Yeah,
common, right?
it was very common. That's actually how my mother grew up in St. Petersburg or in Leningrad, like in the 40s and 50s. So yeah, they had like 10, like an apartment with 10 rooms, and 10 families lived there. So they had like four people in one big room, I guess, and maybe like a couple of bathrooms, and like or maybe even one bathroom just for like a 10 family. So so that's that was definitely common, but yeah, thankfully it wasn't that. Although some people I knew had that kind of situation. Yeah.
And so by 96, was it fairly easy to leave by that point, or was it you still had to jump through a lot of hoops, or?
Well, I mean, I was somewhat sheltered from that whole process, so I don't want to say that it was completely easy, but it wasn't the same as the Soviet Union. I mean, basically, once my father got a work visa and my mother and I got like family visas going with him, no one, like, that was basically all that had to happen,
How old were
and
you
then
at the time?
I was 15.
15. Okay. And so when you got to the States, did you then have to like apply for green cards or citizenship and all that stuff, or?
Eventually, and also like it was the entire family. My parents and I all applied for the green card as a unit at the same time, and they actually kind of pushed us a little bit ahead of in line, because I was about to turn 21, and at that point I would not be able to apply as the same family unit. So they actually had like a category called aging child, which meant that they would try to push you through before the child and the family turns 21, which is what happened to me. So it was a little bit of an expedited process. I mean, I guess it took a couple of years, but and eventually I became a citizen in 2009.
And where did you come to? Did you come to Boston? Is that right? Or
Worcester,
Worcester, yeah,
Massachusetts,
okay.
which is still where my parents live, and my father still works at WPI. But I spent 11 years in Boston, so that was kind of
So
my main home for a while.
you're this is interesting. So your grandfather was a track and field coach, your dad a college professor, mathematician, and you are a poet. So
Yeah, my mother is
how did
a
that happen?
my mother a piano teacher. In a music school. No, I mean, they all, like, my father wrote poetry. My mother was very much into the arts, obviously, with all of the, it was a concert pianist, and taught in music school for 24 years. So it was like, my father had also like written a screenplay. They had, made a movie at some point when he was like in his early 20s. So it was a very, that was a, I mean, they were encouraging me to like write and be like read a lot, and kind of be interested in literary things. So really, since I basically started writing some kind of poetry when I was like 9 or 10, and it was very much encouraged.
Okay. And then say, so did you study literature in college, or yeah?
Yeah, literature and filmmaking, poetry and filmmaking. Yeah, interesting. Like I went to a math and science school, high school, and so I was kind of like on the mathematics side at that point. But I did have a more of a passion for the humanities and for literature and for storytelling and all of that stuff. So, made a few movies as well.
Oh, okay. Is that something you're still interested in, the filmmaking, or?
Yeah. I mean, it's. I was just thinking. earlier today, it's like, you know, there's more poetry films being made these days, and I feel like I need to get back into that. And I had a few of my poems, maybe like four or five, were made into short films by other people, and I've made one film based on that poem, on someone else's poem. Mm-hmm. But I feel like I should at least kind of get back into short films, at least, even if they're not like, because I in college I did not full length, but like half hour long fiction films with a screenplay and, you know, storyboards and, you know, a camera person and a crew of like, mm-hmm. I mean, like 30 people would be involved in them in one movie, like in my thesis film. So it was like kind of like a regular, fairly long short film, you know, fiction. But, you know, maybe I could at least do some more small scale experimental stuff.
How does that suit you working in a film? Is like such a, like the collaborative environment, I think, where you need a lot of people who have very particular skills versus, you know, being a writer where you just get to do everything by yourself, more or less.
Yeah, I mean, it's very different. And it takes an adjustment, I think, you know, when I was, well, obviously, when you're writing a screenplay, when you're thinking about a future film, mm-hmm. it's very much like, you know, you could spend, you know, months or, you know, years for, you know, a lot of people just developing something. And it's very much like being a writer. But, yeah, I mean, it becomes interesting, like when you're shooting things and you have this crazy schedule of like 16-hour days and, you know, have like 30 people there and everybody has to be coordinated and make sure that nothing bad happens and, you know, people catch colds or,
yeah.
you know, get rained on or the police comes as soon as you pick up the camera because, you know, that's just how the world works.
Because you're not using permits or...
Even if you have permits, you know, just kind of like, as my film professor would say, you know, the main rule of filmmaking is as soon as you pick up the camera, the whole world turns against you.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
And then a physics professor told me in response to that, well, the moment you try to do anything, the whole world turns against you.
That is so true. Yeah. that is so true. I know that as a publisher. I wouldn't say the whole world, but there's always, anytime you actually do anything to put something out there, somebody yeah. gets mad. Somebody doesn't like it or has an argument.
Yeah. Right.
With you about it. But and who was I think there's also a quote from Herzog that I love. They asked him, like, what's the most important thing to know about, like, making films? And he said, always bring bolt cutters with you.
Yes.
You never know when you'll need them.
Absolutely.
And so what kind of poetry were your parents into? What did you absorb when you were younger that was like you heard around the house or that was just in the atmosphere in Russia at that time?
Well, I mean, it was definitely in the atmosphere of Russia. But, you know, my father is tired of me telling the story to everyone I meet. But he used to actually whisper poems to me like when I was... 2 weeks old, 2 months old. Like instead of lullabies, he would sometimes read poems to me to lull me to sleep. So like Arseny Tarkovsky is probably the first person that I heard, whose poetry I heard. Uh-huh. And I was probably 2 weeks old when that happened. And also, you know, I think when I was 9 or 10, I started reading Pasternak. And I that like really inspired me to like suddenly start writing mm-hmm. some attempts of like almost imitating him in some way, you know, just basically start to write poems at that point, which, you know, of course, you know, are really cute if I read them now. Uh-huh. but yeah, I remember kind of like falling in love with the you know, Pasternak and Nekrasov, and, you know, obviously Pushkin. And, you know, and obviously Sergei Yesenin is someone that, yeah, I wasn't necessarily, like, into Yesenin at that time, but he was somebody that's, like, just so pervasive in Russian mm-hmm. culture that right. you couldn't help absorbing some of his poetry.
Right.
So, you know, by the time I started this project, you know, I realized that I basically almost knew a dozen of his poems by wow. heart, and I never wow. memorized them. I just kind of knew them because they were, like, around.
And so we're talking about the book, The Last Poet of the Village, which will be released yeah, by the time sure. you hear this podcast. All right, I've got one, you've got one, which is the Selected Poems by Sergei Yesenin, translated by Anton Yakovlev. And it's a great book. He did a great job, and it's a real important book, I think, because he's, again, for people who haven't heard of him, he is, I mean, I tell people after Pushkin, maybe he's the most yeah. well-known poet in Russia. And
I would say so.
Yeah. And you said, you know, 1,000 of his poems by heart just because you've been exposed to them, or
I said a dozen.
I thought you said 1,000.
Oh, that yeah. would be interesting. 1,000. Wow.
Yeah, because aren't they using, like, people still use his poems for lyrics and pop songs and things like that? Or
oh, definitely. Yeah. It's like the, you know, you listen to kind of like the Russian versions of, like, The Voice or, you know, America's Got Talent, whatever, like mm-hmm. the X Factor, the competitions, and you would hear, like, I mean, you would hear Tsvetaeva as well, you would hear, like, just some of this silver era, you know, like early 20th century Russian poems set to music, and a lot of them are just, like, extremely cripplingly tragic and devastating. And, you know, they're, like, put in the context of this, like, happy-go-lucky sort of pop competition. But if you actually listen to what they're saying, it's like, oh, my God. You know?
That's funny. But, yeah, so I guess for a Nickel-Turney Amerikonsky like myself, you know, I know all the lyrics to Jesus Christ Superstar. That's what we grew up with, you know, things, the pop music.
Well, Jesus Christ Superstar, or, you know, and you, Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan, that sort of thing. That's I think typical American exposure to poetry, or else, I don't know, you just made me think about this when you're talking about how your dad was reading you poetry when you were a baby. I think the poetry that probably most Americans get exposed to at a very young age and can probably recite passages from by heart is Dr. Seuss.
Dr. Seuss.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. And Dr. Seuss is also deeper and more subversive than most people think.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Kind of like the same way that Robert Frost isn't just this kind of like pastoral farmer. Uh-huh. You know? There's all of those Easter eggs, so to speak, of darkness and depth in many of their lines. But I mean, in a way, like growing up in the 80s and, you know, the 90s, there was a lot of sort of liberalization and de-censorship of sort of the avant-garde from the early part, the early half of the 20th century. So a lot of people would say, well, you know, I grew up with theater of the absurd. I grew up with futurism. I grew up with, like, things that were forbidden under Stalin. Like, you could go to jail for reading Yesenin or you know, a lot of the
Yesenin, really? Was
Yesenin,
suppressed?
Yeah.
Okay. Obviously, people suppressed. Like Mandelstam and Mayakovsky, yeah. obviously. And,
Yeah. So there was, like, a lot of this rediscovery of things that, you know, but just like 70 years too late, or, you know, 60 years later, like Master and Margarita, you know, which wasn't published for, you know, many decades, you know.
But Pasternak, Pasternak kind of escaped the purges, though, was one of the few, right, who was sort of acceptable.
Well, acceptable. I don't know. I mean, I guess to some extent.
To some extent.
I mean, everybody had their ways of sort of trying to work with the system because they essentially wanted to survive. And, you know, sometimes that's precisely their attempts to work with the system is what got them killed.
Right.
You know, in the case of Yesenin, like Trotsky was one of his kind of patrons. You know, he was somebody that really liked his poetry.
Uh-oh.
And he was a supporter.
Yeah. That worked for a while till it didn't, I guess.
That worked for a while until it didn't, which is why, you know, there's still these theories that, like, you know, the accepted theory is that he killed himself, but his grandchildren do not think so. A lot of people do not think so. And there are a lot of medical examiners and people that kind of look back at the evidence. You know, opinions are split. There are multiple theories for, like, how exactly he died. You know, basically, you know, arguing in both directions, and it's really hard to quite... But I think ultimately the reason that it's plausible that he might have been assassinated is that he was kind of uncontrollable. He was his own person. He was very stubborn. Mm-hmm. He just followed his muse and just followed his opinions, which were very strong and very uncompromising. So one moment he would be praising the revolution, and then the next moment he would be writing a subversive play where, you know, you could easily see, like, maybe it's a historical play, but all of the characters are based on somebody that's acting or that's around right now. And it would be very scathing and very kind of derogatory and, you know, essentially he was a force that no one could really restrain. And he was just not controllable.
Yeah, but there were an awful lot of poets and artists back then who committed suicide by shooting themselves in the back of the head. And so what were people doing to keep his work alive? Was it just the samizdat? Were people just passing around leaflets and keeping them hidden in their houses? And
well, it was a lot of things. I mean, he was extremely popular. Like, he would gather thousands of people in, like, stadiums or whatever, concert halls, doing his readings. Even then, he would just, like, tour around the country in, like, provinces somewhere. So there was a lot that was available. So, you know, not everything was obviously confiscated or burned or whatever, or disappeared. But then, you know, some is that. And also one of the interesting things, you know, people just memorize things. There was a lot of memorization, a lot of just kind of keeping things in your head without having it on paper. And one of the things about Yesenin is that he has a very lyrical style, and obviously in Russian, it's in strict meter and rhyme, and that makes it easier to memorize. And, you know, my translation, I chose not to do strict meter and rhyme, but, you know, I tried to approximate it to some extent. But the thing about meter and rhyme in 20th century Russian poetry is that it continued to be prevalent, and it continued to be kind of the dominant way of writing poetry, even as, like, the English language world was going into free verse a lot more. But in the Soviet Union, it was actually a subversive kind of way of it was a resistance strategy, because people would memorize poems. And they would specifically use meter and rhyme to make it easier to memorize, to make it easier to remember, so that you don't have a document, but you keep it in your head, or you can transmit it to someone orally. But, you know, if they come in and search your house, they don't have any evidence that you have this subversive poetry.
Wow. It sounds like Fahrenheit 451.
That book was very, you know, even though I didn't really live through that, but of course, you know, I grew up kind of learning about all of that stuff. I very much, that book felt very, very much familiar to me, and somehow just that spirit of it.
So first, if anybody hasn't read it, and they really should, but Ray Bradbury, so the premise of the book is that books are illegal, and but there's underground subversives who have decided to keep books alive, and everybody has one book that they have to memorize and then pass on to another person. But yeah, and I guess there's also another way that people got around the suppression, which I also imagine, well, I guess I know, went up and down. Like some years there were like crackdowns, and other years people were allowed to do things and people looked the other way, right?
Yeah.
But there's also the science fiction writers, right? So like the films of Tarkovsky.
Yeah.
It's like, oh yeah, this is just about the future, about some other place or planet, or what's his name? Stanislaw Lem.
Yeah, well, he's Polish, but yeah, he's, I mean, the Strugatsky brothers that wrote the novel Picnic on the on the side of the forest or something, which is the movie The Stalker was based on. I mean, they did a lot of that. They had a lot of sort of veiled messages in their science fiction novels, and they were like universally beloved. So yeah, science fiction. I mean, even right now, I mean, the one of the biggest sort of rock musicians, Boris Grebenshchukov, who is, you know, in his 60s right now, and he has a lot of kind of political commentary in his songs, but then he would have like a faun at the same time, or he'd have some sort of like a mythical creature, or like, and say, well, you know, this is just, you know, I'm just talking about like this magical kingdom that I came up with. Like, nothing to do with anything going on today. It's just, you know, I'm not criticizing the Russian Orthodox Church and its corruption. I'm talking about, you know, my equivalent of Middle Earth.
Yeah, and what's the name of that band who's like, gosh, I can't remember. They're super popular in Russia. There's like an 8-piece band, and maybe this is the same guy you're talking about, and they're very subversive and are in and out of trouble all the time.
Well, not Pussy Riot.
Not Pussy Riot, no. And I believe, did you ever see the Anthony Bourdain episode when he goes to Moscow? And he actually interviews the guy from this band. And their name skips my... They're pretty wild.
Maybe DDT? DDT?
I don't think so. No.
There's Leningrad.
That's Leningrad, yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. And they're actually... They have their final tour, and they're coming to Madison Square Garden in November or December, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, sometime.
Are they going to be in the rest of the U.S. or just New York?
Maybe more than New York. Oh, I'm not sure.
I've got to look that up. I'd love to see them.
They may be. Yeah, I actually did see them once in Revere Beach, which is north of Boston, in this small club. Interestingly, I guess in 2009, maybe. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I mean, like, they're not that much in and out of trouble. I mean, they're like extremely outrageous and a lot of profanity in their songs, which is not like their thing. But yeah, I mean, they've had the you know, they scored soundtracks to some really big TV shows, you know, so I think they're accepted.
They've become acceptable, but I don't think, I got the feeling they weren't acceptable, like when they were starting out, or, yeah, they're kind of shocking. Yeah.
But I mean, I guess they did use the shock value as a kind of, you know, it's something that makes you a pariah for an extremely long time, until suddenly you become huge.
Right. Or
commonly known in the underground, and then the underground suddenly becomes mainstream, like everybody knows.
Yeah, just like everywhere else. Yeah, I mean, that's the old. it's an old say, but it actually happened here in near here in Sausalito. There was a woman, I can't remember her name. I think it was Sally something, who ran a famous brothel in Sausalito back from starting in like the 40s through the 70s, back when Sausalito was, believe it or not, a rough town, you know, like a sailor's town, not like a tourist trap like it is now. She ran this notorious brothel that many famous celebrities who would pass through San Francisco would go to visit, you know. High-end clientele. And anyway, by like the late 70s, she ended up becoming the mayor of Sausalito.
Oh,
Right?
well,
So,
very
yeah.
cool.
So, oh yeah, but the other thing I wanted to say was about Lem, is that what was the name of the book? I think it was called The Futurological Congress. And it was about but it was really it was so obvious to me. Must have been obvious to other people, but he was talking, it took place, this futurological congress took place somewhere in Central America. And the United States was the big part of this Congress, and it was pushing around all the other countries or whatever. And so he's just saying, like, all these, like, really biting commentary about the United States and their, this imperial. But it was also very obvious that he was really talking about the Soviet Union when he was doing it. But he got away with it because it's like, yeah, you could, it's like I'm sure you've heard that old joke about the American and the Russian talking about freedom of speech. And
I think I have, but
right. And
go on.
the American said, in America we have freedom of speech. I can go and stand in front of the White House and say, Ronald Reagan is an asshole. And the Russian says, well, we have freedom of speech too. I can go in front of the Kremlin and say, Ronald Reagan is an asshole.
Ronald
Right?
Reagan, exactly.
Yeah.
I think even Nixon, there was a version of that joke with Nixon.
Yeah, I think it's probably an ancient joke.
FDR.
FDR, yeah. Rutherford B. Hayes. No, that would be too early. But yeah. So what else are you working on these days? After finishing the CNN and during your CNN and.
I have a, my most recent chapbook of poems came out late last year, less than a year ago in November. It was called Kronos Dines Alone, and it was published by Survision Books in Dublin. It's a surrealist publisher specializing specifically in surrealism, and I think it was very much up my alley. And I have a couple. I basically have like two manuscripts that are complete that I always keep working on, and I just I gotta send things out. And but I have basically like two full-length collections that eventually, at some point, hopefully, will be published. But
And you have a book called Ordinary Impalers as well.
Ordinary Impalers, that came out in 2017 from Kelsey Books. So that was somewhat more, maybe a little less surreal and more personal poems. That one kind of like just happened. It combined some of the new work that was like 2016 or so with some of the poems that I had written like in like 2003, 2004, 2002 that I had looked at again and revised, and kind of like rediscovered that there was actually something there. But yeah, basically, at this point, I have, I continue writing new poetry, and
Yeah, that's good. I mean, it seems like you're starting to get a lot of recognition, and hopefully much more so when this hits the stands.
well, I. Certainly for the sake of Yesenia. I think the interesting thing about this one is that, I feel that I really want this book to kind of be known and be out there because, it's not really so much about me, it's about Sergei Yesenin. And because there hasn't been a bilingual edition of his poetry so far as we know, and he's been very much underrepresented, I feel like the more I can do to just sort of make people aware of at least the fact that he existed, and then that he was, I guess some people know Arzadora Duncan, and some people know that, oh yeah, there was that Russian poet that was married to her briefly, but they really haven't read any of his work.
No, I'm surprised at again, so this is a great service because I think he's been very sparsely translated into English, period. Never mind there not being any bilingual edition. So this is great for, you know, for anybody who's actually studying Russian as well as Russian poetry. But yeah, when I mentioned his name, like everybody's heard of Mayakovsky. Very few people have heard of Yesenin. So hopefully, hopefully we can make that change a little bit.
Yeah. And so, in some ways, it's easier for me. Well, it's easier, but also kind of like more nerve-wracking for me. It'll kind of like I want to do justice by him. You know, it's not just about people not liking my poetry. Like, who cares? But you know, in this case, it's like it's about his poetry. So I want to kind of respect his legacy. And you know,
that's it. That's interesting, because I would have kind of thought it was the other way around. But I mean, I know you want to do it justice, and it's challenging and whatever, and it's important. But at the same time, it would seem like, well, I've got this great stuff to start with. It's not about my work so much. So I don't know. I'd like to. It's interesting to hear your viewpoint as a translator, as opposed
to there's an extra sense of responsibility, because I'm not just working for myself. I'm not just representing myself. I'm representing someone else. Right. So, I mean, I'm not saying nerve wracking in like some sort of a oppressive, horrible way. But I mean, like, okay, you know, I better do right. You know, I better do something good. Otherwise, it's kind of like I'm not letting myself down. You know, who cares if I let myself down? I'll just, yeah, you know, I'll write more poems later. But in this case, it's like, okay, you know, this is an existing body of work, and I made a selection of, you know, some of his more kind of popular poems. You know, I didn't really so much go into his longer work and his more politically subversive things. This is more of an introduction that anyone can really pick up and kind of dive into and get a first taste of it. You know, maybe in the future I can translate some of his more obscure work, but this is sort of like just very much his most celebrated poems in Russian that people know and love. You know, kind of did my best to essentially share their essence, you know, their meaning, you know, like I was like approaching the translation from the point of view of like, I just found out this poem. I just read this poem. I love it. I got really excited about it. I want to share it with my friends. Oh, look at this great poem I just read. Oh, but they don't speak Russian. So what do I do? I'd better translate it into English in such a way that, you know, I don't introduce myself. I don't like try to change things around so that it sounds really nice in my voice and make it my version. I just want kind of like to get as close as possible to the meaning of the poem and to what he was actually saying, which is why I decided that translating in, for this particular poetry, translating in meter and rhyme was not going to work. I mean, and I actually had translated some poems into English in meter and rhyme, but you inevitably bring in more of your own voice and more of your own kind of idioms. You replace things.
You're basically rewriting as opposed to translating.
Yeah, to fit the meter, and it might be great, but it's a different kind of translation. Right. And I think with Yesenin, I've read some, you know, a few great translations of him, especially by W.S. Merwin, but I've also read a lot of bad translation by him, and most of those tended to try to retain the meter and rhyme, and they kind of made it sound too sing-songy and cheesy, and they replaced some very nuanced images with different images that were possibly quite a lot more cliche and a lot more just sort of trite and not interesting.
It's also, I guess it's funny because in English, that's like one of the most pejorative things you can say about poetry. I suppose that it's rhyming poetry, right? Whereas, you know, it's doggerel. You know, but whereas in Russian or French, I suppose, it's just part of the nature of the language also that it's going to.
I mean, the neo-formalism has made a comeback, you know, to a great extent, and there is a lot of great rhyming poetry being written these days. So hopefully that is changing. But there is also, You know, there is a lot that can go wrong. And
yes.
I think in this particular case with translating Yesenin, I haven't seen any good rhymed translations of Yesenin. I mean, they probably exist, you know, I probably just haven't come across them. But, you know, for me, just for how I approach them, for how I, like, basically, I tried to translate them in a way that would make me continue to feel passionate about reading them and feel like I'm actually conveying what Yesenin is saying. Because he has a lot of subtle turns of phrase that are almost cliche or almost expected, but not quite. Mm-hmm. There's like something going on,
mm-hmm.
something a little, and sometimes it's, you know, kind of like the same way that Robert Frost did, actually. There are things that kind of sound nice on the surface, but if you think about it, it's not just, he's not saying the direct sort of simple thing that you think is saying.
Right.
There is something about the verb tense or something about the choice of words that is a little off,
right.
That's or a little more thought-provoking.
Or even to go back to Dr. Seuss, it's like
when I
was reading those to my kids when they were growing up, I was like, hey, wait a minute, this is I think the everybody knows green eggs and ham, but one fish, two fish, red fish, blue fish. There's a lot of stuff going on in that book.
But
anyway, you did a fantastic job with this, and I know you worked really, really hard, and it took an enormous amount of effort, so kudos to you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Would you like to read us a couple, three poems from this?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see. Well, I'll read this poem called Hooligan, which is sort of one of his credos, or one of his sort of personal statements.
Mm-hmm.
He very much had this, he had an interesting personality that he kind of cultivated. He simultaneously was very scholarly and approached writing poetry like a very sort of almost like a festive thing, like a very solemn and important undertaking. He was very organized about it, but at the same time, he would like get into fights in bars,
right.
or get into arguments. You know, like if he felt he was misunderstood, he was like very kind of very quick to cause a scene or to get outraged. So, you know, in a way, like he had this, his known as a hooligan, and he actually wrote a lot of poems about that, but at the same time, you know, it's not, that's not all he was. He was actually very meticulous about his writing, and he was very you know, he had read an insane amount of literature and was really working hard. But you
know,
he had
people
that.
Like that too.
So, Hooligan. The rain cleans the willow dung of the meadows with its wet brooms. Go ahead, wind, spit your clumps of leaves. I'm a hooligan, just like you. I love it when you blue woods like oxen with heavy steps, soil the knees of the trunks with their foliage wheezing bellies. Here it is, my ginger herd. Who better to sing it praises? Yes, yes. I see how the twilight licks the human footprints. Russia, my wooden Russia, I alone am your bard and town crier. I fed the sadness of my beastly verses with mignonette and mint. Rustle up, midnight, the jug of the moon, to scoop up the milk of the birches. It's as if the churchyard would like to strangle someone with hands made of crosses. Black horror walks the hills, stirring a thief's anger into our garden. Except I'm a lout and a bandit myself, with the blood of a steppe horse thief. Who among you has seen the host of cherry trees boil in the night? All I want at night is to stand with a bludgeon somewhere in a blue steppe. Ah, the shrub of my head has wilted. Song's bondage has sucked me in. I'm condemned to grind the millstone of poems in the chain gang of feelings. But don't worry, demented wind. Keep calm and keep spitting your leaves over meadows. That poet label won't kill me. I'm a hooligan, just like you.
Great. I have to ask you, what is the Russian word for hooligan?
Hooligan.
I thought so. Okay. All right. Do you want to do another one?
Yeah. So I read this one, which is the first line of the poem is, I'm the last poet of the village. Mm-hmm. And it's actually the title of the book, which I picked because it encapsulates Yesenin's sort of raison d'être and his zeitgeist, so to speak. And, you know, I'm the last poet of the village has kind of a double meaning, like the last poet in the village and also the last poet that writes about the village. And, you know, I think part of the reason that he was so popular and that he is so popular in Russia is that he kind of cultivated this rural peasant sort of imagery in his poems that was kind of quintessentially Russian, that a lot of people related to, and that kind of felt different, felt kind of like had this national identity and, you know, something special about it, about the kind of all the rural landscapes, so the rural lifestyle, which incidentally is what one of the reasons that he quickly started to object to the revolution and the industrialization that was starting, because he could see that it was not helping the peasant, the people in the rural areas that he sort of considered his extended family and his, where he came from. He felt that the industrialization was kind of encroaching upon it and destroying the culture. But anyway, so this is called The Last Poet. It's untitled, but the book is called The Last Poet of the Village. It's sort of in honor of this poem. I'm the last poet of the village. The wooden bridge is modest in my songs. I'm attending the farewell night service of birches hemorrhaging foliage. The wax candle of flesh will burn its last golden flame, and the moon's wooden clock will wheeze out my 12th hour. Soon the iron guest will appear on the path across the blue field. His black palm will collect the wheat spilled by dawn. Dead alien hands, these songs won't survive when you show up. Only the wheat stalks, like horses, will mourn their old master. The wind will suck on their mane, dancing its dance macabre. Soon, very soon, the wooden clock will wheeze out my 12th hour.
All right. One more?
Sure, yes. Let's see. There's another poem that...
This is always such a treat for me, by the way. I should mention when I do these podcasts and I get to get these one-on-one private readings with people, it's pretty great.
Yeah, private plus whoever ends up listening to it.
Oh, come on, nobody will. Google doesn't listen to this transcription.
Google doesn't listen. That might be the next. That would be a good title for a poem. Google doesn't listen.
They hear everything, but they don't listen.
They hear, but they don't listen. Yeah. Well, that's also why I have never unpacked my Alexa. I won an Alexa in a raffle, and I never got it out of the box.
Dude, you couldn't pay me to have one of those things in my house.
Yes, yeah. It's like James Tate line, even free, that blender was too expensive. Anyway, back to Yesenin. Also untitled, as many of his poems are, but they're known by their first lines. Since ancient times, a special measure has existed for all living things. If I hadn't been a poet, I probably would have been a thief and a conman. Thin and short, always a hero among boys, how often I came home with a busted nose. To my frightened mother, I hissed through my bloody mouth, "This is nothing. I tripped on a rock. This will heal by tomorrow." Now that the scalding grip of those days has cooled down, a turbulent, insolent power spills all over my poems. A golden pile of words, and every line, without fail, reflects the former bravado of a rascal and a troublemaker. As before, I'm courageous and proud, but there's something new in my walk. I used to get hit in the face. Now it's my soul that is bleeding. And these days, it's not to my mother, but to an unfriendly laughing rabble that I say, "This is nothing. I tripped on a rock. This will heal by tomorrow."
All right. Well, Anton, it's been great talking to you. And the book will be out October 15th, The Last Poet of the Village, Selected Poems of Sergei Yesenin. And available, be on Amazon. That's the easy way to get it. But you can go to your local bookstore, order a copy. Go to your local library and order a copy. Let's just get copies out everywhere. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. And thank you for this great conversation. And anybody has any questions for me, just can email me or whatever. I'll talk to you some more about Yesenin or
all right.
Anything else.
Okay.
So thank you.
All right. Thank you. Talk to you soon.